And we are back with an all new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I remain Louis Vertel.
And we are joined by a special guest this week, returnee Travelle Anderson.
Hi, thanks for having me. Glad to be back as always.
Is this your third, fourth time back?
Oh, I don't remember. You know, it's been a minute. I have bad memory.
You were here at some point. Yes,
yeah. They know me. It's fine.
They do. How are you doing over at What a Day?
It's great. We don't wake up this early in the morning for recordings, but I love it. Shout out to Gideon and Priyanka and Josie. We're doing it.
I forget that we are still the quote-unquote early podcast. We're like lighthouse keepers over here or something.
Well, we pull up the graveyard shift. You know, we're out late.
I think at one point we used to record Keep It in the evening.
We did a couple of them. I still get all my news from Inside Edition, so this entire process is unfamiliar to me. Deborah Norville, we love you. Why was I just thinking about her? Oh, Katie Couric wrote about her in her memoir. That's going to be a good one anyway. Something I'm excited about for the future.
Katie Couric is on a tear. Who isn't she talking about in this memoir?
No, I like her very casual kind of cat-eyed candor. Just, I'm going to rip everybody apart. Yeah.
So I did not get to see No Time to Die yet, Louis, but you said you had thoughts.
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, I saw it extremely late last night. So I look like one of those Garfield comics where he's sleep deprived, like that level of baggy eyed, whatever.
I was debating doing that. I landed back in LA and I was like, do I see this 10 o'clock showing of this film? And then I saw the runtime and I said, absolutely fucking not.
And by the way, if you went to see it at like an AMC, you then get a half hour of previews beforehand. So you're really there extra late as I was.
We are going London in the US. I don't know if like you've seen like a movie in the UK, but I went to see Widows and there was an hour of commercials before trailers.
Oh my God, what? That's so the for like a newsreel footage and stuff? Jesus Christ.
They're out of fucking control. So I think that's where AMC is heading.
Got it. I will say this. I thought it was an okay movie. I'm actually surprised anecdotally to hear my friends really love it. To me, I thought they forgot to make James Bond interesting. They just assume he's interesting. The stunts look great. Actually, all the women in it, I think, rule. And I underestimated what a big part Lea Seydoux would have in the movie. She's obviously a big part of Spectre. Loved her in Blue is the Warmest Color.
I think part of that thing about him being interesting is what is a holdover even from the last one. Mm. All these movies, as opposed to the other Bonds, are really doing like this is a continuation. And so they're not really they haven't really been introducing him in a new interesting way each film. It's sort of like, well, you saw the other ones, right? So you know what he's like.
Louis, I have a question though. Is it worth the runtime though?
I will say, I mean, I'm somebody who absolutely needs to be on some sort of medication for paying attention to things, and I will say for a 2-hour and 40-minute movie, I wasn't unentertained, didn't want to fall asleep or anything. So for me to say that, I think most people would find it exceptionally entertaining, I think. But my God, is that long? You're right. I mean, you know, if you have important quilting or something to do, maybe do that instead. I don't know. But I will say, like, I think what disappointed me most is, like, the villain is extremely typical. As Rami Malek plays him, and in the first scene he appears, I was actually sort of digging it, and we're sort of getting over this hump of Rami Malek's past few performances we weren't such a big fan of here. Maybe he was getting back into the groove, and then eventually he becomes one of these villains who's like, do you admire my topiary? You know, just like all the other fucking Bond villains. So I think that was a little bit cliche too. It was too familiar in certain ways to me, other than Ana de Armas's character.
The good sis.
Pretty good. This is part of her upswing.
Okay. I'm ready for everyone else to start standing Ana de Armas because all I needed was Knives Out. and her daily and her breakfast walks with Ben Affleck.
Right, which was, I believe we consumed that content 4 times a day for a while during the pandemic. So,
so much that she like has a new man, I think, and they are, you never see her.
Wow, what happened?
I guess she was like, you know what? I did it once. I don't need to be in a celebrity relationship anymore.
Mm. Speaking of celebrity relationships, we really don't think about Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz enough. I mean, is there fanfic about these people? I want to know more.
Do you really, though?
I would love to. I mean, they're just
No, no, no. What was... we have to stop now. Rachel Weisz is the allure of the 2020s for me.
She's a queen. I feel like the only thing that they do as a couple is that he loves to emerge from the ocean like he's Bond. Like it's mm-hmm. like, yes. like there's always paparazzi photos of him in a Speedo emerging from the ocean. And I think that's just the one thing he picked up on from playing Bond that he does now during the off season.
If you're going to pick up on anything, I'm going to recommend that, though, because he does that well while remaining utterly stone-faced.
He's sort of like he did that recent GQ spread, and I would describe Daniel Craig's hotness as like vintage Clint Eastwood with like a moisturizer plan.
Yes. It shouldn't work. He should look dehydrated.
Yeah.
And yet he doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, come out more. I would love to just find out where they're eating at.
Right.
Come on, Dumois. Focus on real celebrities like Daniel Craig
yeah, no kidding.
And Rachel Weisz. well, Travell, I'm sorry you had to come here this week for...
it's all right.
For this topic. But Dave Chappelle does have a new special.
Yes,
and
he does.
And the girls are talking.
Aren't they always talking?
I like how the word special sounds so shady when you say it under certain contexts. So here he is with his special. Special it is.
Yeah. We also are going to talk about the world of celebrity podcasts, because that is also where the girls are talking every day. Every day.
Arguably too long.
Entirely too long.
Arguably many more than you would ever imagine. It's like, where's Jody Sweetin's podcast? Okay, because I'm sure it's somewhere. And then also this episode, Lewis and I have a wonderful conversation with Carrie Brownstein.
Jesus, is she fab. She came on the mic and we were like, blown back, you know, Marty in Back to the Future when he turns on the amplifier and then flies back into the wall. That was us with her just speaking.
Of course, she is here to discuss The Nowhere In, her new half documentary scripted with Saint Vincent. There's many ways to describe this movie. I'm gonna let Lewis do it.
Yeah, it's bizarre, but also what's weird is it's kind of like Portlandia in that you watch it and you think, well, Carrie Brownstein's not like a comic. She's like a rock star. What's she doing in this context? And then you watch and realize, oh, no, wait, you're naturally funny, too. But that's not your job. I'm upset. And St. Vincent gets to be funny in this, too. And then it's also serious. And then it's also real. Then it's also not real. So anyway, lots of sublimating of genres going on here.
Yeah. So we get into that. We get into Slater Kinney. We get into music. It's a good combo. So we will be right back with more Keep It. Philip Picardi's podcast, Unholier Than Thou, is back. Season 2 is all about the wisdom of everyday people falling down, getting up, and trying new things as they navigate re-entry into a newish world. Catch up on the first episode with Samita Mukhopadhyay, former editor of Teen Vogue, as she and Phil dive deep into the lessons of grief and how to rebuild relationships over time. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts. Last week, Dave Chappelle released his 6th Netflix special, The Closer, which did not feature Kira Sedgwick. So
she couldn't have come out one time.
I'm already mad. The closer is coming. The closer is coming to Netflix are words that should excite me. And yet it was deception. So
you seem really broken up about it.
You know, I believe this is the last of his $20 million deal with Netflix, which is good because after doubling down on anti-LGBTQ rhetoric, particularly against the trans community, a lot of people would like him to shut up.
Please.
So I will actually say that it took me a while to get through this because the first time I tried to watch it, was falling asleep.
Because it wasn't funny or because you were just tired?
I both, but I was confused by some reviews that said that it was funny before it delved into the end, which they think that like ruined it and ruined his like Netflix special legacy. And I was angry from the jump because I thought it was unfunny from the beginning.
Well, it's also just a whole lot of fixating on stuff I wish he would, one, move past. And also he promises he's going to move past it, and then we're just in it the entire special. So, again, you promise something. First Kira Sedgwick, now this. And I'm left wanting both times.
Yeah. I think listen, the last special, 846, you know, which was about police violence against Black people, that one at least felt like there's a reason for him to just, you know, like strip away. I'm doing a comedy special and have it be more like he was having a conversation. And I remember finding that one moving, even the one right before that, where I feel like he was first like getting loose with the trans stuff. That one at least seemed like there was some jokes up front. I feel like I remember on this show, but you know, we've been doing this for too many damn episodes. I think I at least remember being like, part of this was funny, you know? I just found none in it this time. It was like he was up there pontificating. It was like he was up there with thoughts. Like he has really no interest in doing stand-up comedy anymore, but he has things to say. And where else is he going to say it besides in one of these specials, you know? It's like, it seems like he wants to be writing books or like having a podcast where he's just talking about this shit. And I mean, I don't know, maybe the next step is like a spinoff of the Joe Rogan Experience.
Here's the thing. I did not watch the special because I do not want to subject myself to all of that. I've seen all of the others. I actually was at his comeback, his initial comeback. I was working at the LA Times at the time and was sent to cover it. And that's when he first started making these anti-trans, you know, type of jokes in a small way. And I don't know. I just feel like Dave Chappelle doesn't have the range to be having conversations about LGBTQ identity at all. And based on my understanding of this special in particular, you know, he does this thing that like cishet Black men do where they feel like they are the most oppressed, right? Mm-hmm. When in reality, if we were going to play the oppression Olympics, they would lose by a landslide, right? Mm-hmm. And he...
Just like Jesse Martin when he ran for president.
And I think it's one of those things. It's one of those things where Dave Chappelle is tiring and exhausting to me, as is Kevin Hart, as is all these other comedians who want to rail against cancel culture, even though they actually haven't been canceled. It's just, I'm just over it.
He seems tired. He seems tired in the beginning of the special, and it's still nonsensical rhetoric to me because it ends with, you know, like, you know, stop punching down on us. There's all these years, all these specials, and you cannot acknowledge the fact that Black queer people exist, Black trans people exist. It's like the entire community is white. to him. And I will say that, like, I know that he has talked about his trans friend who died before of suicide, Daphne Dorman. I did not know she was white until this special. I had never seen a photo of her. And now it makes sense.
It makes all of the sense.
Now it makes sense. I was just shocked. I was like, oh, a friend that he has, you know, I thought it was like maybe like a black trans woman, like, you know, from, you know, someone he's known since his youth or something. I didn't know, really, like, know the depths of the relationship. I didn't care to dig into it. But I was like, how are you acting like just no, black queer people exist? I'm like, oh, this woman is white. But if you are a white trans woman who has the chance to be friends with Dave Chappelle, meaning you're running in sort of the same circle, like, I'm not going to assume that you know what you're talking about either. It's giving Caitlyn, you know? I'm just like, if you are going to be a person who's out there as like the defender, or the person he's using to defend his jokes, then, like, you know, you were clearly in some different sort of, like, you know, social sphere where this shit doesn't matter to you.
At some point, he says something like, I know trans people make up terms to win arguments online. I'm like, dude, you're literally making up trans boogeymen to make any of this make sense. The amount, like, he's talking about, like, they bother you in your Twitter mentions, or they're like confronting you with this. It's like he keeps characterizing all trans people, and I guess like younger LGBT people as nags. It's like you can keep pretending you're humanizing everybody by trying to talk about LGBT issues, but literally you can't even characterize them once fairly. You know, it's like he's the one who's not bothered and everybody else is bothered, you know, which goes back to what Travell just said about like the cancel culture thing. It's like everybody else is histrionic and I'm, you know, over here trying to keep my cool. It's just super boring. And also,
does he even have a Twitter account?
Who's finding him online through his publicist or whatever?
Who's
I don't know.
His mentions? You don't right. have mentions.
But it's like at this point, it's like anybody who would care to want to talk about this as a serious issue is not coming to this special for like a constructive argument. They want to find Dave Chappelle funny first, and then any residual intelligence in the conversation, they're just going to chalk up to his genius. It's all about like loving him ultimately. And I just find it super tedious and super, like, who comes out of this thinking I really learned something? And I really do think he thinks he's here to be didactic and instructive.
Mm. You know, I also think that it's this hunt that comedians have for the, you know, the like last great joke, you know, as I think Ray Sani has called it, the last great joke, which is the trans joke. You know, it's like we know comedians love to, you know, sort of like push the envelope, but just certain ones. And what's the last thing that they can sort of like make fun of to find like a good joke? And it's making fun of trans people. You know, they're like trying to find one that like pops, that is funny. And no one is doing it.
I don't know. I feel like we all love, or all of y'all love Dave Chappelle because of the Chappelle Show. We thought that he...
Ooh, all of y'all.
All of y'all. Because...
not Chappelle.
Because we all thought, them. Y'all thought that he was speaking to, you know, the lived experiences of black people, and he was doing it in a way that like no one else was doing it on TV at that time. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's true, right? But like he just doesn't have the range to have this conversation. Like in the special, I was reading Eric Deggan's review over at NPR, and he says in the special that Dave Chappelle makes this joke comparing like, you know, black rights to like the gay rights movement, and says that like if slaves were oiled up and had on booty shorts, that, you know, maybe they would have been freed 100 years earlier or whatever the case may be, right? Which, one, the idea that there weren't queer people who were also enslaved is just like ahistorical, first and foremost.
Right.
Secondly, it it borrows on this like continual, you know, divisiveness that LGBTQ people are always pitted against Black folks, and it ignores, as I think you said, Ira, that like I exist and that Ira exists mm-hmm. at the intersection of Blackness and queerness, and for me as a mm-hmm. non-binary trans person. And Dave Chappelle, time and time again, has shown us that he's not interested in that intersection and acknowledging that intersection.
It's silliness. It's tricks. It's Fruit Loops. It's also just so weird when Black people don't get it, because it is, it's really the simplest binary. Black and white. When you talk about queer people like pretending that they weren't enslaved, mm-hmm. that also ignores the fact that there weren't white queer people who were enslaving Black queer people. You know, it's like mm-hmm. it doesn't matter if you're queer or not. It matters whether you were Black or white, you know? And so there also is this they can acknowledge the fact that, you know, like whiteness, you know, like permeates the media, and, you know, like you, and that is how, you know, Black people, other races are subjugated or, you know, are racially stereotyped, et cetera, but can't acknowledge the fact that maybe the most visible queer people you see in the media, them being white, is because of whiteness, not the fact that all queer people are white, you know?
Right. Very that. And then I also think about the ways in which, you know, so much of Dave Chappelle's thing is about trying to challenge audiences, right? And so he thinks he's so progressive. He thinks it's like a, you know, that whole equal opportunity offender thing. But one, I think comedy has changed to where like, that's at least not funny to me. And I'm sure there are millions of people who are out there who it is funny to. And some of them can be queer and trans as well, right? Because we are not a monolith either. But the fact of the matter is, like, we don't, as trans people, we're not waking up thinking about no damn Dave Chappelle. And so why the hell do we factor in so much to his comedy of late? I just don't understand. Like, as
well,
a Black man, he's
Netflix.
It's because of Netflix.
It's because it's global, you know, because the girls are releasing the specials. The girls at Netflix, the Netflix girls. Sally and Ted Sarandos.
That kind of blew my mind immediately after this was posted, and obviously Dave Chappelle has like tons and tons of defenders. Like, there's no such thing as this Chappelle special coming out and like not all of his like very serious fans coming to his defense. But like, I'm just reminded of the Nanette conversation about how it wasn't stand-up because she wasn't joking the entire time, or, you know, it was a one-woman special, technically not stand-up. And it's like, meanwhile, then these people are coming here to defend this quote-unquote comedy, which at one point he just calls himself a TERF. Like, so, like, that's stand-up to you? Mm-hmm. It's like, why are we receiving serious messages from only men? Why are cis men? You know, why can't you take all comedy voices similarly seriously? And that's when it comes down to, it's like men worshiping another man, and whatever he says is fucking true to them. That's how it felt to me.
And you know, speaking of Miss Netflix, they are in the news also because a trans employee was suspended after tweeting about Dave Chappelle. But you know, to get into nuance, you know, they're also alleged that they crashed a meeting on Zoom that was for executives. Two other employees were fired for getting into, you know, a meeting that higher ups were having on Zoom. And
you can do that on Zoom?
I mean, if you got the link.
Oh, I see.
If you got the link, you can jump into anything. You'll be let in, you know, and I mean, there's a lot going on here, but just the fact that, you know, you have employees even feeling like they need to speak out against Netflix, and Ted Sarandos's statement wasn't giving to me. You know, it wasn't giving. It was like, you know, we don't think that this sponsors hate, et cetera, which is foolishness, because specific references in Disclosure explain why Dave Chappelle's special can cause violence towards Black queer people, especially Black trans women. So maybe Ted missed that one.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because in the little memo that he wrote to the staff, I think The Verge published it, he cites Disclosure being on the platform as an example of Netflix supporting, platforming, you know, trans LGBTQ work. But I don't see how you watch Disclosure and then also believe that these quote unquote jokes that Dave Chappelle is putting forth aren't going to materially lead to the types of violence that in particular Black trans folk experience, right? Because those are the types of things that we know that folks who've committed violent acts against trans people say, right, to invalidate our humanity and justify, you know, their violence, right? And so it just seems, Netflix wants to have its cake and eat it too, right? They made it clear that they're not taking this special down because Dave Chappelle's specials do very well for that platform. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's watching it, right? He's like, we gonna get our money's worth out of Mr. Chappelle because we gave him $20 million, right? But it definitely leads to the same violence. And also, one thing that Dave Chappelle just does not notice or recognize is that, you know, the people in the trans community who bear the brunt of the violence that the trans community faces are Black folks, Black trans women and Black femmes, right? And the perpetrators of that violence are more often than not Black cishet men like Dave Chappelle, right? And so I think ignoring that type of context, it allows you to get up on stage and say that, like, you know, you punching down, punching up at everybody around you. But who's actually getting punched, right? Who's actually getting killed, right? And it's folks who move through the world like me, as opposed to folks who move through the world, you know, like him, right? And so it's just like, we just need more nuance in these conversations, ultimately. And he just does not have the range.
How are you punching down at DaBaby, you know? Well, I know technically yes, because most people are taller than him, but you can't punch down at a billionaire celebrity rapper, you know?
Right.
You're not punching down at him. And if he's losing shit, like endorsements and things, then that he did that himself.
That part.
I was also blown away that he went to like the Mike Pence joke area too. Like, God save me from 2017. Please, please stop. Please, I don't want to hear it ever again.
I was like, also, you mentioned we were safe. I thought we were safe. Why am I still hearing Mike Pence's name outside of a January 6th commission report?
you also brought up Disclosure after watching the special. I mean, how annoying is it to even have to see all those people from that movie have to talk about this special? It's like, because he has this special, now this entire conversation about them is oriented around him. It just found it so annoying. Like, and any outsider would find that annoying, that he would like kind of have the gall to make to be the center, the hub of that. Really annoying.
And the comparison of it to other projects on Netflix that, you know, cause some controversy, like Cuties or 13 Reasons Why, I think is, you know, a false equivalency. I know it. They know it. But, you know, it's going to take someone with a bit more weight to discuss this at a higher level at Netflix. You know, I just get my checks.
Guys, put on Cats, Cops, and Stuff by Paula Poundstone, the greatest stand-up hour ever released. What? Paula, come back. Wait, don't tell me.
What?
it's my favorite stand-up hour ever. You've never seen it? The year was 1990.
My favorite stand-up is the snippets before each episode of Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah. He nailed it every time. That was routinely the worst part of the episode, was it not?
Yeah, yeah. It was.
It was.
That was where all the what's the deal jokes would be. And it would sort of be like in a punchline, audience laughs, and then cut back to him smirking.
By the way, Seinfeld, not my brand usually. Do you know what I have weirdly been sucked into? Jason Alexander interviews. Jason Alexander, super brilliant. I mean, one of those people who remembers everything, too. Look up his Television Academy interviews. Very informative. I, like, learned something about how you film a sitcom and stuff. I was shocked.
I know. I really like Jason Alexander. I think he is the one who... he's the one from Seinfeld who has the most failed TV shows, right?
Oh,
he certainly has a number.
Yeah, he's like did he have a one that was longer running after that?
He certainly had Bob Patterson, which lasted, you know, not as long as Seinfeld.
You know, I would maybe posit that with, I feel like he's the one with the more of the film career.
Well, we enjoyed him in Pretty Woman, certainly.
Okay, first of all, Hunchback of Notre Dame. Okay, Dunstan checks in. All right,
oh my, the best Faye Dunaway okay. movie. Oh my gosh,
Cinderella.
Yes, the black one.
Yes, yes. Come on, come on. And he was in some episodes of Monk, which isn't a film, but I just love talking about Monk. I never get the chance to anymore.
Congrats.
All right, when we are back, Lewis and I get into it with Carrie Brownstein, but there is more coming up with Travelle after that.
Hey, Crooked listeners, if you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at crooked.com/friends. Check it out.
Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves. You're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit NCL.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry: the Bahamas and USA.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Our guest today is what you would call a multi-hyphenate, I suppose. A musician, writer, actress, comedian, and director. You may know her from Slater Kinney or the feminist bookstore owner in Portlandia, and she is currently the writer and star of The Nowhere Inn with her friend St. Vincent. Please welcome Carrie Brownstein.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Hi.
We're thrilled to have you. I was just thinking about this movie. How annoying is this movie to describe to people? You could be like, oh, it's a mockumentary, but it's like three other movies inside it too. So I'm wondering if this promotional tour is among the most stressful things you've ever done.
It's a little stressful. We should have thought of that when we were making the film. We should have reduced the elements and the hybridity by 90%. So we could have just said, it's a rom-com. Lots of hijinks. I don't know.
Dermot Mulroney dates you both. Yeah, whatever.
Yes. My dream. Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott. Who I conflate by name alone.
Yes, yeah. You know,
I believe that's their fault.
Dylan is actually my favorite TV actor, I think Dylan is. So I will always remember him. I think it's just from growing up watching The Practice.
Oh, The Practice. Yeah. I think I also like him from the first season of American Horror Story.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Mm-hmm.
Yes. This is a podcast about Dylan McDermott.
No, wait, but really, did you know that Dylan McDermott, I think I'm right about this, is the adopted son of Eve Ensler, who wrote the Vagina Monologues?
No. Wait, like,
isn't that crazy?
Like,
yes,
as
he was adopted as a teenager. Yes.
I love, this is a deep cut, and I think a tangent that, I mean, willing to go down, but that's an amazing fact. And amazing that it was when he was a teenager, not as a child. I mean, like,
yeah,
not as a, like,
sort of dating her. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
right.
Okay. Gotcha. I thought you just meant, like, fresh from the orphanage, like Eve Ensler just went in, or like, okay, that makes more sense. That makes more sense. Okay.
Okay. Now,
foundling Dylan McDermott.
His father's third wife was Eve Ensler.
That's did you right. just look that up?
Okay. I did. I did. We have like a bunch of pop culture in our brains, but sometimes it does fail us. So gotta go to Wikipedia very quickly.
I think if you want me to bring this full circle, we could say this, the difficulty we've been having describing Dylan McDermott is similar to the difficulty I've been having describing the Nowhere Inn.
Speaking of your describing of the movie, though, you did an interview with The Observer, and one of the influences you listed for this movie completely surprised me. But then I saw the movie, and I was like, I think I get it. Phantom of the Paradise, an amazing Brian De Palma film, which I feel like so few people have seen. What do you love about that movie, and how did it inspire you in The Nowhere Inn?
Well, there's a lot of things I love about that movie, just starting with how bonkers it is. Like, it just, it's a real, that whole genre of, I don't even know what that genre is. It's like, you know, part musical, part horror fantasy. But I love that kind of weird risk taking that seemed available in the 1970s, like, to just do something that did sort of defy categorization and expectations, and just kind of the meshing of genre, you know, and also just throwing in like clear loves of like De Palma, like, I love music. I love, like, it just, I don't know. I just kind of liked the freedom that the movie seemed to embrace in terms of like not adhering to like structural norms, and also just some weird camera moves, and I don't know, just the whole thing is such a bananas freak show that I really loved it. But it also, like, the character is kind of classically like sad and sort of lonely. Like, at the core of it is a, you know, a very traditional story about a lonely person seeking connection. I was inspired by it, by just that kind of elasticity of I don't know, like, norms, and just kind of taking the script and the shooting style, and just being like, how can we sort of push this and not make it something that people expect, I guess. That was the main influence, was just nothing, just kind of trying to move away from like traditional documentaries. And I love like when films like that, or I'm Not There, or 24-Hour Party People sort of just approach music with this kind of like 360 degrees, like, we're never going to come at this straight on, so let's just kind of keep circling around it. And every time it goes around, you kind of catch something different. You're on this like amusement ride that's like a little bit dizzying. And to me, that's kind of the experience of music, you know, as a fan of it. You just like, every time you approach a song, it's subjective. It's where you're at emotionally. And like, it comes in like colors and waves. And it's just hard to come at music with a linear story, to me.
Something I also thought was interesting in hearing you talk about this was you mentioned how often music documentaries can be authentic, and then also they conceal a lot, or, and I take that to mean also that a lot of them are fan service as opposed to being a documentary about the subject. And I was wondering, do you like music documentaries in general, or do you find yourself annoyed at what they're actually setting out to do?
No, I love them. I love even the ones that where the contrivance is so clear. You can just, you know, feel like the amount of control that the artist had over it. Just like, there is a scene in the Lady Gaga documentary that is absolutely amazing. Have you guys seen that one? You know,
yeah.
Where she,
5 for 2.
Yeah, yeah. 5 for 2. Mm-hmm. You know where she goes to her, is it her grandmother's house? And she brings up her dead aunt who she named the album after, Joanne, right? Mm-hmm. And
right.
He's trying to get her, you know, it's a very staged moment, and she's trying to get her grandmother kind of to cry over it. And I think just they're coming at it from such disparate experiences, and you can just really see in that moment, like, two kind of competing interests, you know, like one is a woman who's like been grieving this probably, you know, since the day it happened, and who knows where she's at emotionally. And then, you know, Gaga's there to just sort of like bring it home for the film. And you just, in that moment, it's just this sort of strange truth of just like, you can't, you know what I mean? Like, artists are such vultures, you know, and she's clear. And that's the truth that's revealed in that moment. You know, there's a lot going on there. So even the ones that feel contrived, or, you know, all of a sudden in that movie, she's just sitting there with her assistants when she takes her shirt off. I'm like, oh my God, I love that boldness. I like moments like that. And I don't judge. Like, I'm like, okay, that's great. That's, you know, that's what she wanted to show. Like, but so I can enjoy them for the sort of ridiculousness and the transparency. And I feel like they're smart enough to know that, like, their fans, they know it's been puppeteered, I guess. Mm-hmm. But then I also love, like, a great, you know, like the Nina Simone documentary, which is actually amazing, or the Muscle Shoals documentary, like, mm-hmm. you know, and music films like Rock and Roll Circus. So I feel like, as I feel you guys are both good at this, like, the high and the low, to me, they're both beautiful. Like,
yeah,
I can't discount either.
The one recent one I really loved was the David Foster documentary, which is sort of like,
I gotta see that.
You watch it and you are like, this man is an asshole and everyone hates him. But the theme of it is, but he's just so fucking good at his job.
So we keep going back and working with him.
I like that idea of, like, the artist is the vulture, and even this concept of, like, when we're watching things like that, you get to a point where the audience knows what they are getting. They know the puppets and the strings. I mean, I explained this to Lewis, who's not much of a reality TV person, but I am. And I find that is sort of the thrill of watching even, like, a Real Housewives moment for me, because you have a person who's decided that they're going to be on TV and they need to talk with their family and show you their history to the audience. But when you have someone sit down and talk about, you know, remember when you abandoned me as a kid when I was 3, you've already had this conversation with your mother, but now you need to dredge it up again for the audience. And I find it so interesting as artists in general, you know, it's constantly you are revisiting things from your past and deciding what you're going to give to your audience and sort of how emotional you're going to be. Have you found that you've had, like, a push and pull with that, you know, since, like, making albums, you know, since the 90s?
Yeah, but I feel like there's almost a safety in having started, I think, before this era of where there was a currency created out of likability and relatability. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the 90s, just any pre-internet era was a different time where mystery was still kind of part of the equation, and the kind of the process of discovery in terms of, like, what you were looking for about an artist was, like, that journey was a lot more sort of personal and arduous, you know, whether it was, like, finding magazines or, you know, like, trying to just, yeah, it was a whole different process. So I feel a little lucky in that I didn't enter the sort of public sphere sort of having to, like, be fully formed, you know, and I can kind of straddle that line a little bit. I definitely kind of appreciate privacy, and I think I can only ever be myself, I guess. I think I missed the opportunity to sort of come in fully, like, with the persona. I just, the 90s were so earnest in some ways, you know, like even the 90s are kind of having a comeback, and you think of, you know, like Britney, or you think of all these like people from the 90s, and like, they just were out there, you know, like just with all their contradictions and mess. And now there's sort of a reckoning about it, but that's just what you did. There was no reason, there was no medium through which you could kind of like filter yourself literally or figuratively.
Right. It's interesting what you say about relatability now, because I don't think relatability would bother me as much if everybody didn't decide to do it the same way, which is it feels like you're seeing the same kind of self-deprecation again and again, or the same kind of faux modesty, or I don't know, like this, the same kind of Instagramming and tweeting. And do you find yourself frustrated at how musicians relate to their fans nowadays? Does that feel like, does that make you want to get away from the internet altogether?
I mean, it's a tricky question, because it's like, I don't want to get away from fans, you know? I mean, that's that.
Yeah.
Like, I like that there's a shortcut to communication and connection. But I do think that sort of like parasocial kind of like false intimacy can definitely exist and be sort of harmful. But that's not just between fans and, you know, performers. I mean, just think of the false intimacies we create all the time. I mean, sometimes I think I could just replace the person I text in the morning with almost anyone. Like, if you just send out, like, all you need is, you know, or like when you get on a plane and you're like about to fly, I mean, you know, as long as you, that recipient could be any number of people, but it's just like the action of sending it. Like, I don't know. So there's a lot to like navigate right now, but I would be hesitant to, you know, like disparage, I guess, the connection, because it does, I guess if I had had that when I was young, you know, maybe that would have been like very enlightening and helpful for me. But I definitely am. I don't share too much. So I feel like I don't think people are counting on me for that. I think other people are in more precarious positions. So yeah, I feel all right about it.
Lewis and I were talking this morning a bit too about the recent album, Path of Wellness. And we were also talking about The Center Won't Hold. And what's interesting to me is we were talking about this era where I think the sort of female rock musicians go through this era where, you know, critics sort of are angry when they go too much in a pop vein, you know, like the album you worked on with St. Vincent. And it's weird for us as gay men who love female rock musicians, but also tend to love those kinds of albums. You know, we were talking about Liz Phair's second album. We were talking about Beautiful Garbage. And so for this album,
Liz Phair's fourth album, for the record, moving on. Yes.
Yes. And for, you know, The Center Won't Hold, I really enjoy that album. Do you have a different relationship with that album now that you've made Path of Wellness? Or do you still sort of feel the same way about it?
I love The Center Won't Hold. And thank you, Ira. I feel like, yeah, it's interesting. I'm very proud of that record. And I also loved collaborating with Annie, with St. Vincent on it. You know, mm-hmm. I think I was really confounded in some ways by, especially because I felt like we had moved past this sort of like, you know, where pop was kind of this lesser like musical category. You know, to me, pop has always been part of the great like DNA of most. I mean, you know, like even the great rock bands, like a lot of their songs are catchy. Like melody to me is the kind of the key ingredient for translating like feelings, and also just for lasting, for being timeless, you know. And it felt, I was like, maybe Sleater Kinney is just, we're sort of trapped in this like certain kind of like a Venn diagram of kind of didactic thinking. You know, it's like the 90s, which were much more like, you know, strident and kind of punishing in the the conversation about like selling out when genre was still very like compartmentalized and there wasn't a lot of crossover. But I was like, oh, haven't we sort of moved past that? But then I was like, oh, or maybe we're still being kind of compared. Like we're like the context from which we come is like still defining like what we should do. But it felt very prescriptive, I guess, the response to it. But I like it. And I think with each album, we were always trying to do something a little different. And it wasn't a direction that we had landed upon. It was sort of just a way of exploring those particular songs. And I think we wanted the sound to be both corrosive in some ways and maximalist, which we hadn't really done, and also catchy. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And Path of Wellness was not a reaction to that. I think it was more mm-hmm. born of the insularity of the pandemic and writing under different circumstances and, you know, just a different musical vernacular, but certainly not let's course correct away from that. In fact, I think we learned a lot from Annie's production and her approach and applied it, you know. So we felt like it was just adding more tools to the toolbox instead of like and just, you know, some kind of gross experiment gone awry. But, you know, people will either decide that it was a good album or they won't. And that's fine. I think when you have 10 records, you can't expect everyone to be on board with all 10.
Speaking of St. Vincent and this movie, something that I found so fun watching The Nowhere Inn is interpreting how much of your dynamic in real life like was on the screen, because you're both at times playing extremely fictionalized versions of yourself. But then at sometimes I feel like I'm watching just an actual snapshot of your lives. And I was wondering what parts of your dynamic specific to the both of you were you interested in getting on the screen?
Oh, that's a good question. Definitely that version of myself does feel a little more feckless than guileless, and also maybe more manipulative than I actually am. And then of course Annie, you know, she is, I don't know if you guys have ever chatted with her, but you know, she is like a very like sort of down home Texan in terms of her conversational style, and you know, very funny, a little more self-deprecating than, you know, she is on screen. But I think the part of it that felt like we wanted to, I guess, maintain or showcase some of our like true dynamic is just that like wrestling of ideas and, you know, kind of coming at things from different perspectives. And it might not be that polarized, but we certainly have an ongoing discourse, I think, about, you know, relatability, identity, how much to share, you know, what an artist owes their fans. I think those kinds of conversations we are real to us. I think we, you know, we made them a little more like of a kind of either or polarity in this film. But I think that that is true. A lot of the other stuff just isn't real, but we did find ourselves descending into these roles where I would show up to set and, you know, my character was a little frumpier, again, a little more fumbling. And Annie, you know, like she was getting clothes from like Gucci and Chanel and Saint Laurent, and like all my clothes for the film were from like Limited Express. Like my character's budget for the film was probably like $250, and hers was like $250,000 or something like that. Not really, but like the disparity. And so like we would both be like getting dressed, and then we would go into the makeup trailer, and she would just, it was like these like birds like fluttering about her like putting on makeup, and they would look at me and be like, you're good. I'm like, really? Gosh, you haven't applied any makeup. They're like, no, but I think that's probably fine. So that started like almost affecting us more than just like even our own dynamic. Like I could feel like this sort of us heading in these like disparate, distinct directions. And it helped for the film. And then when I was done, I was just like, when we go to the wrap party, I'm going to be so dressed up, you know, like that, which is the cliche of every wrap party. Like I don't just wear cargo pants, guys. I can also wear heels is like the MO of like every wrap party. Anyway.
to ask one last question, you are, you've been on, you did Portlandia for years, you know, and what about Portland do you find that you still enjoy? You know, after you've, you know, had to sort of, you know, like mine it for comedy and, you know, sort of have it become part of your identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, certainly it's such a cheesy term, but it does kind of feel like my spiritual home in that I just grew up in the Pacific Northwest and there's things about the landscape and like the various, you know, greens. It's so verdant here and like the gray skies and all that stuff, which is, I know, not what you're asking about, but it is part of what I love about it. But I think on a more just like day-to-day level, it's unwavering earnestness, you know, and you guys read about it in the paper. Like it's not, you know, just malignant or annoying, like, or just all these things that people ascribe, you know, to it. Like as they read these stories of like, you know, there's a lot of tumultuousness here. And I think, you know, differing like factions, like kind of warring right now, but the bottom line is it is an earnest city. And I think it really tries and it is in conversation with itself, which it can be stultifying, which can be really tiring, but can also, I think, bring about some good awareness, but it's an interesting place. I do love it. And it will always be one of my homes for sure.
I visited once and I feel like Powell's bookstore, I felt like Belle walking through the Beauty and the Beast town. It was like, that's the only place I've been like where I feel like, oh, people listen to podcasts, they recognize your voice, and they want to talk to you.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's such a sweet town.
Exactly. I mean, I think that is, that's the irrepressible part of Portland. And people are fans of minutiae and niche things, and you know, and truly you probably are a rock star here, you know. And that's, I think, the, like, that kind of different way of looking at things, what they appreciate, is a nice way to live and to be a part of. So yeah, come do your rocks. You can do a podcast here in the Moda Stadium where the Blazers play. You can do a live show here.
We would love to.
I would love that.
I mean, though, if I saw you in Portland, though, I mean, it'd be like seeing like Bjork in Iceland. It'd be like seeing the Statue of Liberty in New York. I'd be like, well, there it is. It's all it's all happening right in front of me. The thing I know about Portland.
Look at me and say, there it is. That's a compliment every woman wants to hear.
Those three little words. Yeah.
It is, that can be a little weird, but I think because I lived here before the show, like there is kind of there's a continuity and a seamlessness. But yeah, maybe it is weird. I try to just blend in, you know. Baseball cap, big sunglasses, huge trench coat.
Like Jessica Alba going to the grocery store. Yes.
Your muse, yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Carrie.
It's lovely to talk to you both. Big fans. And I just really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, what a pleasure.
Yeah, a real pleasure. Coming up next, celebrity podcasts. Why are there so many?
Hey, Crooked listeners. If you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at crooked.com/friends. Check it out.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks,
like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
After the announcement of Lindsay Lohan's forthcoming podcast made it evident that any celebrity who does not have a podcast currently will have one soon, we thought it'd be time to look at a corner of our own industry, the celebrity podcast.
It's a dicey idea. I just don't trust celebrities to be candid, period. In order for it to be fascinating, they almost have to be ruining their career. So
yes, I feel like we only hear about a celebrity podcast when something salacious happens, you know? I mean, the Bethany's podcast went viral recently because she too wants to talk about trans people. So maybe that's the hot topic. Maybe that's what we need to do to really get keep it going viral.
Is it?
Yeah, you know what? I don't want them in the same bathroom as me. How about that?
What you didn't see was the sassy neck movement he added to it to really add gay flavor to the transphobia.
How about that, honey? No, but it does seem that like every celebrity podcast at some point delves into like extremely strange stories from either the host or another celebrity friend that they have on, and they always make the news, which is why it seems like a new show is always being announced, like Lindsay's, or you know, like Ellen Pompeo has one. I talked about it last week when she was sharing weird stories about fighting with Denzel Washington on set, you know. Oliver and Kate Hudson have one called Sibling Revelry. There's Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert, Anna Faris, Alec Baldwin.
That's a good one. I enjoy Anna Faris's quite a bit.
Unqualified is very good. It's good. Alec Baldwin, Jenna Fischer and Angela Kinsey called Office Ladies. We know why that one's popular, because people just can't get enough of The Office.
I was going to say, I don't think there's a single TV show that I could listen to an entire podcast dedicated to, even something like I watch Jeopardy every day. I couldn't even do it for that, I don't think.
Buffy, I could.
There's too much shit going on.
I could. Yeah.
Buffy?
Yeah. Well, I've been on Buffering, a podcast, wonderful podcast. I've been on that one. I've been on Slayer Fest 98. Actually, I enjoy dipping in. You're right. I can't really listen every week because I'm like just listening because I feel like podcasts about TV shows, they recap the shows and you get into them. And it's fun when there's like a certain fun guest or like if I'm having a conversation. But most of the time, you know, I just let the girls do it, you know.
I mean, there are people who really love these types of podcasts. Again, mm-hmm. I am not one of them for the most part, mainly because I don't care about these folks or these shows. I will say the Michelle Obama podcast was really good, particularly the episodes when she's like talking with her girlfriends and you know she slips into her Michelle Lavon Robinson. So I like that energy, but like the majority of these, it's just like, who really wants to hear Prince Harry and Meghan Markle? Do you really?
Well, certainly not Kate.
I would love a Pablo Larraín movie just about Kate, as in nothing dramatic even has to happen in her life. I just want to see her walking around a beautiful home or something, you know, looking a little stricken and hearing the news about Meghan Markle and maybe not even reacting.
You want that to be the third installment in his women running around a house? I think maybe I said it on here that I wanted it to be Princess Peach.
Oh, that'd be fun. Also, I love characterizing these as women running around a house movie, like it's Mother or What Lies Beneath or something.
Like Bill Gates and Rashida Jones Ask Big Questions. That's a podcast that exists, Ted, for 5 episodes. So I guess they asked all of them.
The interesting thing is the interesting thing about podcasts is it's weird to complain that there are too many of them, though, because they don't take up actual airspace. Like, a part of me is like still using the brain of like network television where it's like, oh, if there's too much of this, there's less of something else. But unfortunately, the limit does not exist, to reference your friend Lindsay Lohan you just said earlier. But by the way,
she is my friend.
You are my friend.
Lindsay Lohan is come on, keep it, girl. My good friends, my good sis.
Okay, now this is up to Lindsay to answer. Why are people so fascinated with her still? I'm sorry. The amount of chances we have given the girl to not just one, do right, but to be interesting. Like she danced one time and then gays like wouldn't shut the fuck up about that for 4 years. Boring. I'm sorry. I don't like mess.
Okay, well, now she's not going to come on the
podcast. She's not coming at all, honey.
Takes a fucking lot, Lewis.
It's like the Paris Hilton people. What? Like, nothing is there. What are we talking about? Yeah.
Well, you know.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Did I sabotage our big ratings opportunity? Well, me talking about networks shit again. Oh, no. We want a 3.1 or whatever.
You know, there's also, like, I feel like when celebrities start a podcast, too, they often, like I said, the Bill Gates and Rashida Jones ones, they can also just sort of, like, vanish because the celebrity gets bored doing it.
Right. There's no rules when it comes to celebrities.
Dakota Johnson had a podcast that had 6 episodes, and then it vanished. Although, that could have been Ellen.
One of her many Game of Games is controlling the podcast industry. There should be a thriller about being stuck in Ellen's Game of Games. Like, you never end up outside. You're still in the studio somehow. It's like Truman Show.
I mean, I'm sure when it shuts down, when they have the final episode of Ellen, that means that, like, they just burn the studio with everyone in it.
Oh, she's like Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca, just watching the Burbank studio crash.
And I feel like a lot of these are also just sort of like promotional things. You know, I can't imagine like I Weigh with Jamila Jamil does much beyond get into, you know, the topics of her like I Weigh venture, you know?
Right. You know whose podcast I did like the couple times I listened to it was the Sean Hayes one with Jason Bateman. That's a fun one. Sean Hayes, I enjoy. Smartless is the name of that podcast, yeah. The problem with these podcasts, though, is if I sense any tentativeness whatsoever, and this is, then I have to turn it off. Because what I want is that weird feeling of like, we're all friends and we're shooting the shit, aka no one else is listening, including your publicist.
But the publicist is always listening.
Right. Oh, yeah. They're right on the Zoom. I can see some right now.
Yeah. That's my publicist in the waiting room. Yes, there is that too. You know, there's the allure of a celebrity podcast. It's like you're going to get some salacious, fun stories, you know, but I feel like you only get the salacious, fun stories if the publicist isn't involved, if somebody says something they shouldn't say. It's always funny when that happens, though, too, because they're producers on these shows. A celebrity is usually doing unless they're really into podcasting, you know, like, Bitch Sesh, you know, which I love.
That's the, I think, best possible version of a celebrity podcast where you give them a topic that isn't about them.
Yes.
You know, like Adam Scott doing the REM and YouTube podcast. Yes. Like, that's good. We can do.
That, you know, is usually, that means that like there's a topic to talk about and then maybe you'll get some other fun stories, right? You know, but usually if you are just a celebrity making a podcast, then you're being paid to do it, you know? Like, you're not doing it because you're hoping it's successful so you can get money. Like, a lot of the celebrities who announce them, they're being paid to have one because the allure is them. But then I feel like if you're being paid to have one, then you're not going to really, you know, do anything juicy.
This is why the podcasts you should be listening to are the ones from like the, you know, the C-level celebrities. Like Kim Whitley and Sherry Shepherd have a podcast and it's fucking hilarious, right?
Okay.
And so like you need the people who aren't like self-involved to host the podcast, because then you get all the good tea, you get the laughter, you get the camaraderie that you kind of want to feel in your ears. But like all of these other like legit celebrities, and that's no shade to Kim Whitley and Sherry Shepherd because we stan those two icons, but all of these other ones, it's just like you're here to promote something else that you've got going on. And it's easy, right? Because you get to control the microphone, you get to control the edit. If you do happen to say something that you don't want nobody to hear, you can cut it out, all of those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just constantly cutting things from episodes to keep it.
Ira gets cut out entirely sometimes just to save us.
It's because I have a lot to say, okay, about queer people.
See, we're gonna cut that.
and so, you know, after that past 20 minutes of you hearing what I just said about queer people, I mean who can disagree with me?
Okay, great.
Don't cut that. Now someone's gonna actually think we cut something from the episode.
Right, yeah.
What did he say? Yes, the ones that are also really interesting to me are the ones where like it's like a celebrity team up, you know, because then you imagine like, you know, like they're friends obviously, and like, but then they get together every week, which is must be such an interesting concept, you know. I guess it's just sort of like if you had a talk show or something together, you know. But I mean, I haven't gotten over the fact that, you know, like Through what I was going on in life, you know, like I see this man every week. I have seen him every week for 4 years.
Right. There's nothing left to mine. You know what? If the movie Tea with the Dames were a podcast, that I would listen to with Maggie Smith and Judi Dench and Joan Plowright. And I mean, those girls let loose. And also it's like when you're that age, they're like, fuck it. You know, we'll talk about how Laurence Olivier was a big dick, whatever, you know, so.
You know, most of the people are dead. Yeah. I would love that, you know, because I think also one of the best flavors of them is like when you have like a celebrity mixed with their friend or something who's not that famous, mm-hmm. you know, so mm-hmm. they can sort of
yeah, they bring it out of them.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They feel more comfortable. I'm sure that's what happens on Kate and Oliver Hudson's podcast, which I don't listen to. I don't, and like it's also not even a show, like I don't care about my sibling that much.
I have an essay question about Kate Hudson quickly.
Okay.
What is her second best performance? Because you know what her best performance is, right? Almost Famous. What would you say her second best performance is?
As Rachel Berry's teacher in New York on Glee.
Glee. That might be it.
Okay.
Because Ryan Murphy can do some stunt casting occasionally.
She was fucking electric on
Glee. That's one word for it. Yeah.
All right. Well, what would you say it is, Miss Travell?
No, we could go with it. We love Glee. We stand Glee in this house. That's okay.
Okay. Do you think her best performance was in Les Divorces?
Oh yes, riveting. Okay, it just had my attention the entire time.
So when you said "in this house we stand Glee," do I live in like another house? Because I would say. The answer is 9.
You've been in many houses where we are playing clips from Glee.
We and 9, which I did not sign up for. Yeah.
You know, I would say 9 is fucking great.
She is great in 9.
I mean, cinema italiano. Chef's a kiss.
What was that? Chris Pratt, Italian man.
Yeah. I would also say, you know what? I mean, there's a reason it's a classic, you know? How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
Okay. That's fair.
Sure.
Okay. She did what Sarah Jessica Parker could never do.
You cannot be saying that. One of my favorite TV stars of all time.
Oh, I love her on TV. I just mean like in her rom-coms. In a rom-com, Sarah is not it. Failure to Launch. Come on.
That was a tough one. That was when we thought we were done with, what's his name? Matthew McConaughey, too. And then...
Surprise, surprise.
Of course, we gave him an Oscar.
Here he is in a movie that I could not finish on my plane. The Gentlemen? Girl.
What the fuck is that?
There's the like Guy Ritchie movie with like him and Colin Farrell, Charlie Hunnam, Michelle Dockery, Hugh Grant, Henry Golding, Jeremy Strong. This should be a cast for me. And I like Guy Ritchie films. Not this one.
Also, so that's what we're doing with Michelle Dockery. Guys, we should be disappointed.
Yeah.
That was a funny pale lady.
All right.
We don't get too many Emily Mortimers around these parts anymore.
We're back. Keep it. And we're back for our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. All right, what are we keeping this week? Travelle, we'll let you go first. You're our guest of honor.
Yeah, well, thank you. My Keep It this week, it's very specific. Last night, I went to the season 2 premiere of Twenties. And as I was, you know, click-clacking my way into the elevator at my apartment. I dropped my keys in that little gap in between the elevator. And it was like a scene out of a movie. It dropped right on top. It didn't move. It was great. As I go to pick it up, it slowly slides.
No.
Into,
into the crux.
Into the crux. And I am just like, what is, first of all, why is that gap there? Okay. It seems completely unnecessary. And then two, my apartment complex is like, oh, okay, we'll get it out, you know, in like a day or two. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? Mind you, I thought that I would not be able to get into my apartment. Turns out, for whatever reason, I left my balcony door unlocked. So it was fine. It was cute. We just walked right on in. It was great. But it's just like, why is that gap there? And I need a new elevator plan that does not have that gap. That way, I don't drop my keys because it's kind of an inconvenience.
I think it's because you're not British, because in London, they always tell you to mind the gap. All right. Okay. Well, that, you know, it's fine.
You see how, like, sometimes on this podcast, a depression fills the room. We don't know why or when it occurs, but...
Usually after I use an accent.
I didn't want to say it. You see, there were some implications going on there. My first day in LA, I was at a horrible office building where I worked at the time. And drop my keys in the elevator shaft. And I just want to say, you are filled with so many questions about how an elevator works and where on earth your keys could possibly be.
Exactly.
What are they at the bottom of? Can people stand where my keys are? You're just like, has anybody ever been where my keys got to? You're right. I don't understand anything about the elevator universe, that there is, when you walk into one, just a little space where if you're an itty bitty, super thin, wheat thin sized person, you could just fall 500 stories or whatever.
Well, you know, it's probably just like rats and Rosalind Shays from LA Law at the bottom of elevator.
Still the best exit from a TV show. So you cannot undersell how good that moment is.
There was a great moment on the recent season of The Good Fight where Delroy Lindo left the show. But there's a moment where he's walking towards an elevator and like they all almost fall into an open elevator shaft and they're like, what the fuck is that there? making you think that that's how he was going to exit in an homage, but it did not happen. That's always terrified me, the bottom of an elevator shaft, like just dropping something in there. Not just there, I was just in New York, like I'm always worried that like, when I'm holding my phone, like, am I going to drop in a sewer grate? It just feels like if something drops in one of those places, you're not getting it back. Imagine crawling into a sewer grate in New York to get your phone.
Elevators should be a safe place to have bottle episodes of sitcoms where you reflect upon all of your past adventures. That's what they're there for.
Mm-hmm. Or you have affairs.
Yes, that too. Yes.
Well, and so to dramas, like trapped in an elevator means you're having sex. So
right, fatal attraction. You're learning just how high Glenn Close can get her knee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, The Good Wife, bringing that up again, one of the hottest scenes ever in an elevator. So maybe
who was that? Elevators. Was it Josh Charles?
It was Josh Charles, and it was
when you said hot, that's where my mind went.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was Josh Charles and Juliana Margulies. So, like end of season one, it was, you know, it was very sexy. So, we love elevators. In this house, we stand elevators, just not The Gap.
Right, but. Just not The Gap, specifically The Gap.
Yeah, get your elevator some Invisalign, okay? Get rid of that gap. Lewis, what's your keep it this week?
I'm sorry to have already brought up Jeopardy this episode because I'm going there again. My keep it is to the online Jeopardy fandom for accusing Matt Amodio, who is the recent 38-time champion, who is on his way to Ken Jennings' record of 74, seemingly without any obstacles in his way. This is somebody who won in a landslide every single day. And then one day, he was winning in the first round, and then suddenly it was like he didn't know how to work the buzzer as much. He had like 5 incorrect responses, which is completely unusual for him. And lots of people have accused him of taking a dive, or the producer, Michael Davies, who just took the reins this week officially, of telling him to take a dive. If you know anything about game shows, you know, rigging one is one of the is so impossible. There are people on set working with every single decision to make sure everything is legit, because it's a fraught situation involving real money. So taking a dive is just basically impossible in this situation, or certainly encouraging someone to take a dive is impossible. And also, it's just possible you can have an off day with the buzzer. There's something about Jeopardy where it feels someone like Matt Amodio makes you feel like, oh, once you get the rhythm of it, you never lose it. But honestly, once one contestant is better than you on the buzzer 2 or 3 times in a row, it can mess with your mm-hmm. head. And I think that's what happened. He seemed very discombobulated up at the podium, which, again, based on how awesome a contestant he is, was strange to see. But guys, I mean, I've been on 3 game shows myself. There are so many people standing around making sure the game is legitimate, particularly one as esteemed as Jeopardy. So stop listening to people online who pretend they know all about the ins and outs of Merv Griffin's gaming universe.
You know, I was asked to take a dive on Next.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I was supposed to say something wacky as soon as I got off the bus.
They told you to throw yourself under the tires?
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
The Anna Karenina of Next.
I listened to a Next podcast.
Would you?
Just about having been there. If it was just about people discussing, like, particularly on the gay episodes, mm-hmm. where they would just make out in the bus and mm-hmm. ignore the game, some of the most subversive television of the 2000s.
I did see someone on Reddit had mentioned that they were on Next, and they said that the scam was that, like when they flew them all there to, like, shoot, one, they, like, get them drunk in the bus. They're encouraged to, like, drink, etc. One of them said that a producer was like, I can't encourage you to drink, but, you know, there is a bottle of vodka over there that you absolutely should not touch.
Good Lord.
And also that
standards, like, and practices save us.
Also that they're flown there for the show. And so, like, there is no second date, which is why that person was like, it's stupid to take the date over the money at the end, because there is no second date.
Pathetic.
Yeah. MTV. Imagine MTV lying to us in the 2000s. I'm shook.
Next was also the cruelest of them, too. People would just be vicious to somebody's face as soon as they appeared.
Yeah. But then that person's also sort of like, you know, like, you're with those people all day, you know, and, like, some of them just cut you for the show stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, I do think you're hot, you know, but I got to cut you, you know, because it's funny. Anyway.
Ira, what's your keep it?
You know what? My keep it this week is I'm going to do a little cosplaying. I'm going to do a preemptive keep it. Two, Lewis saying keep it. Two, the new trailer for Scream.
Oh, you know what? I kind of like the new trailer for Scream. It's not bad. You thought I was going to hate it?
You usually hate trailers. Famously, you hate trailers on this show.
Well, they're here to fool us, you know. Like, all trailers are good, but all movies aren't. So, who's the dummy here? Probably you.
Actually, yes, when a trailer is bad, that usually means there's no saving that film. No. But the new trailer for Scream has dropped. And actually, you know what? I will say a brief keep it to the fact that it's just called Scream.
It's just like when the new Halloween was called Halloween. It's like, no, you don't get to erase it that hard. Like, I still remember that movie.
Right. Yeah. And now it's just going to be like Scream. Like, fans are going to have to say Scream, Scream 2, Scream 3, Scream 4, Scream 2021.
And almost every letter in the word Scream could have been replaced with a 5.
Yeah.
So stop pretending there was an Apple opportunity. Yeah.
Scrify them.
Looking like an Elon Musk kid name.
Yeah. But no, I'm actually looking forward to the new Scream. Maybe it's to keep it up for me because the trailer, actually, it looks entertaining. Although I'm hoping we get a little something fresh, you know? I mean, because from the looks of the trailer, you know, it's very much, you know, Sydney hunting down this killer who's after people. And I'm like, well, if that's the case, then I need her to be a little bit better at it. Right. Okay? Like, because she seems to go and try and find out who the killer is. And then she never finds out until a final act bloodbath where she's been gathered with all of her friends and shocked by who the killer is. Like, girl, maybe you weren't, like, taking your detective classes.
Right. No, I can already picture her like trembling in a denim top while somebody explains the entire reason they killed everybody she knows again. Not super in need of that. But you're right. Like, while it was good,
it's you, part of the mask, you know, yeah. It's like I want one point where they take it off and she's like, yeah, bitch, we knew it was you like an hour ago.
Who is your guest for Veteran Who Bites the Dust? Because we have Nev Campbell in it. Courtney Cox, David Arquette.
He needs to go.
I don't know if anybody, like, I don't think they brought back Parker Posey, which is a crime against humanity.
He needs to go. Well, she's dead.
Just pretend she was.
worst part of Scream 3. I won't drag Scream 3 because I like it, but the worst part was Parker Posey's death. She should have lived. And Dewey should have died many times. So
that is true.
I think David Arquette should go, but I think one of those three veterans has to die for there to be any stakes in this film. I need
kill
there
them
to
all.
Be stakes.
Why
there
not
were no
kill them
stakes.
All?
Yeah, there were no stakes in 4. I enjoy 4, but there's no real stakes in that film.
Killing all of them would be a kind of cool move.
That's how you shake the table just a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, shake
because
that
that's
table.
Actually not been done in a horror movie, like truly eliminating everybody. I mean, I guess Jamie Lee Curtis has been killed because then they'll just pretend it didn't happen and remake it again with all the same people.
Yeah, they did it with Nightmare on Elm Street. Like I feel like that's why I love Dream Warrior so much. Like Nancy dying in that film feels poetic, you know, and it feels like it's sending people off. The Nightmare on Elm Street movies tend to do that. They like the final girl will survive through like the next film or something and then they'll die. Like Patricia Arquette was killed in the next one, the Dream Master.
Oh no! Wait, is Nancy Heather Langenkamp?
Yes, she's back in the third film. Have you seen Dream Warriors?
No, I think that is that the one where it's like every fucking BuzzFeed horror gay is like the queerest movie you never knew.
No,
was queer.
That's
like,
two.
Shut up.
That's two.
No, it wasn't. I bet it's bad.
Well, no, that was a Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, and that one actually is. Fucking faggoty. Like,
all right,
like Freddy Krueger is Freddy. This is that one tries to switch it up by like Freddy Krueger tries to possess someone and then come back into the real world. And he possesses this guy who's like played by an actor who's gay. And it's just sort of like he's right. Walking around me, yeah. Like he's inside me, you know, and like he has like a crush on his best friend. And like they follow the basketball coach who's like abusive to like this leather bar. It's a very gay film. But the third one is actually quite iconic, and it's set at a mental hospital where Freddy's like preying on these kids. And Heather Langenkamp, Nancy, shows up as a doctor who specializes in what's going on. a therapist, and so she tries to help them. That one has Lawrence Fishburne in it. Lawrence Fishburne, Patricia Arquette is one of the leads. So Dream Warriors is where it's at. Also, an iconic soundtrack. So should see
I believe
that.
You for now. I've just been so let down by all these movies that are supposedly like pseudo queer classics or whatever. And then it turns out, you know, like Thor Ragnarok or something is a queer classic. If you look at it a certain way, it's like, no, it's not. Don't tell me what to think.
The only queer classic for me has to have Jim Carrey in it. Okay.
Okay. I Love You, Philip Morris. I thought was that movie. I thought that was.
Now I'm talking
movie.
About The Mask. queer classic. Okay. When he's saying somebody stop me, he means someone stop me from being heterosexual. Right.
I love this text you conferred upon the film.
The Mask is a metaphor for the closet.
Yes.
And you know, heteronormative masculine behavior.
Oh, no, Ace Ventura, het detective. Yes.
Anyway, yeah, the movie looks fun, even though I guess all the iterations of these films are really turning into like Halloween Kills now. Vibes where like these final girls from like a long-standing horror franchise are now just like, come and get me. And then they've got all the weapons, you know, it's giving Terminator.
What about Numb and Number to Gender Norms? What about Bruce LaBruce Almighty? See, these are the gay films we wanted from him.
I think that's the end of our show this week.
When nature calls you to be gay.
Woo! Thank you to Carrie Brownstein for joining us. Thank you to Travel.
Thank y'all.
Thank you to anyone who is still listening.
The majestic nature of being gay.
All right.
I think I'm done with all his credits.
We thought we'd last for 200 more. 201st episode is the last one. Now we're canceled. Keeper's going to be taken over by Jack A. and
probably just Jack A.
Probably just Jack A. Yeah, she do all three parts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, before you all go, which celebrity do you want a podcast from? I want Angelina Jolie. In the wild, every country she's going to help people. I want her interviewing the people in this country. I want her talking about the activism she does, and then I want her talking, like, sprinkling in bits of like her past relationships.
Oh, well, this is a basic response. I think I want Jane Fonda because it would inevitably be about, you know, climate change, the thing she's obsessed with now. However, you get Jane Fonda going about the 70s or whatever, and she's like, you know what? I don't know what the hell happened to John Voight. Like, you will find out some word from her.
The way that you said, the way that you said climate change, it made it seem like you hate Miss Greta.
It's just what she's currently talking about the most. Yes.
You're like, what are you going to talk about? A movie, bitch. Monster in Law 2. We need it. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
But it'll just be called Monster in Law.
Monster in Law Dream Warriors. Yeah.
Travel.
I'm going to go with Dionne Warwick. I would love a Dionne. I want her loose. I want her talking about calling people hussies back in the day. I feel like it would give us all of the energy we need.
Well, let me tell you something. I saw Dionne Warwick in concert last weekend.
Oh, wow.
And she throws down the dialogue. She will scold you in the audience and literally wag a finger because she is like traditional auntie behavior, if you will. And she was really making me laugh. She also sounded good. I guess she had vocal cord surgery a couple years ago, so you could hear her sort of recalibrating her voice, but sounded good.
All right. That makes me think I would want a Patti LuPone podcast.
Oh my God! Look out!
The people,
look
the
out.
People she dragged.
The Madonna chapter alone would be.
There'd be 10 episodes.
Vicious. Yeah.
She'd be like, "All right, I finally watched Evita.
I just watched Evita for the first time in 20 years. By the way, we're going on too long. I know. It was literally is a full-length music video. There's almost no scenes in it. You're just going from cut to cut to cut to cut to cut. Like, yeah. Madonna doesn't even get to give a performance because you feel like you're watching a movie-length music video.
Yes. Anyway. I mean, if you want a real Madonna performance, you need to be at the Red Rooster in Harlem where I was last week.
Oh, I saw those pictures. Yeah. What, marching through the streets with her like the end of Hairspray?
Do it like a prayer. That's how you get people to the streets of Harlem to march. Okay, Black Lives Matter. You need Madonna. It was an equal mix of surreal and insane. Right. And that's all
that's about.
Yeah. Which is how we describe Madonna these days. So,
oh yeah, I saw Madam X. So, yeah.
All right, we're really done this time. We will see you next week.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III, that I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.
Hey, Crooked listeners, if you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at crooked.com/friends. Check it out.